Welcome Underground. We establish a connection with the unknown through the act of giving something and, paradoxically, the act of destroying something. So writes Roberto Colasso in The Ruin of Cash on the subject of sacrifice. The insight that life is death and that death is life is integral to the mystical tradition, and it was embodied in the ritual of blood sacrifice. Did we lose something important when we lost this ritual? Enjoy.
So, today, I want to talk about sacrifice.
You do?
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I feel intrigued, intimidated.
Good.
Why do you want to talk about sacrifice?
Well, I have... I know a little bit about ancient sacrifice as part of my job, and it's a very odd thing when you think about it. And... You know, it's something that was pretty ubiquitous, pretty universal among human cultures up until very, very recently. And it would have been, when we're thinking about the imagination of the past, we have to imagine the past, what it would be like to be there. I think it's a particularly visceral, and I use that word advisedly. It's a particularly visceral piece of imagination to think about what it would be like to attend a sacrifice or to perform a sacrifice. You know what it meant. It's also, I think, the idea of an animal, and we're talking about animal sacrifice here. With
blood sacrifice. I was about to say. So we're going for quite a narrow definition here of sacrifice.
Yes,
or specific.
Yeah. I'm talking, to be absolutely clear, I'm talking about the religious ritual of sacrifice as performed by human cultures. But I'm thinking of the, you know, my area is the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans.
And then so we're talking animal sacrifice.
Blood sacrifice. It's one of those things that is a great thing, I think, to study and think about. And as I say, it's first of all, it's very, very rich in terms of the possibilities of imagining what it would be like, because it would be a very intense experience, I think. But also, it's one of those things that it seems that the meaning of it, you know, what it's all about, is quite nebulous and yet intriguing. One gets the sense of very, very deep pools, but it's very, very hard to pin down, you know, what sacrifice meant. You know, what's the explanation for sacrifice? You know, what is going on here? Why are they, you know, cutting the throats of a bull and digging into its guts and sort of catching the blood and, you know, doing all of this kind of stuff. And
I see exactly what you mean about how visceral it is and how that understanding can kind of give you a different perspective on the period. I was watching one of those R-rated, you know, classically themed dramas at some point. I don't know if it was Rome or Spartacus or one of those other excellent series. But there's one scene where you have one of the lead characters, a woman, I think, just down in some cave, you're doing an animal sacrifice, and they really lent into it. Like, she's just getting hosed down with ox blood, and it's really intense. So then you think, oh, what the hell's going on? And then you realize, oh no, this was a normal thing for everyone in that society.
I think I know the scene you're talking about. I think it's in Rome. It's a memorable scene.
But the fact that I remember it and I remember nothing else about that series, as you say, visceral and makes you think a bit about how different that society was.
Yeah, I think that maybe it might be worth just talking through what the process of animal sacrifice was for the listener. So that they get a sense of what it looked like. And basically, first of all, I'm going to do this out of memory, which is a terrible idea, because I'm probably going to leave something out. But basically,
or put something in,
yeah.
Bernd Herzog calls it the ecstatic truth. It's like, feels right. Yeah.
I'm going to give you the ecstatic truth right now. Ready? Yeah. anyway, so you get, first of all, it would be a domesticated animal, right?
Yeah.
Nobody sacrifices fish, you know, or. Mm. They don't even sacrifice sort of dogs or snakes or, you know, anything like that. It tends to be, and you know, maybe there is some strange rite somewhere in some niche village where they do, but in general, this is for the ancient Greeks at least, it was cows, oxen.
Yeah.
It was sheep, goats. It was piglets. You know, these animals that you would find basically on a farm, animals that are used for meat and for sustenance.
Yeah, and that's interesting from the outset because...
it is, isn't it?
As we see in Africa today, like a cow is really valuable. Like, that is an appreciable fraction of your worth. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to jump the gun, but the value is a big part of the point. So it tends to be animals that you have domesticated and that you have on a farm and that you either use for agriculture or for meat or both.
Yeah.
So
it has utility. And you're normally not waiting until it's really old and decrepit and you kill it anyway. I imagine these are your finest beasts in their prime, are they?
It depends on what you're trying to achieve, I think. And it depends on what you have. It depends on context. Anyway, so you get your animal. Let's say you're going big and it's a cow or an oxen or a bullock or whatever. You would, first of all, decorate the animal. You need to make sure it's a more valuable sacrifice if the animal is sort of unblemished. So if it's a particularly fine example, you know, you might give it a wash. You might gild its horns, so put gold leaf upon its horns, or put sort of woolen bands around its head, or you know, just kind of bling it up a little bit. First of all,
yeah, make it feel special.
Yeah,
I think cats appreciate that as well.
Do they? I'm not sure they appreciated what happens next, but although as you'll see, their appreciation was important actually. So they're sort of, you know, they're blinged up, and then they're led in a procession to the altar. Now the altar would be in front of a temple, and so it's not in the temple; it's in front of the temple, and the doors of the temple will be open so that the god who lives in the temple can see.
Mm.
When you got up to the altar, there would be a priest. There would be a big crowd. There'd be a big crowd gathered all around. There might be a flute player. I mean, it's not a flute, but you know the ancient Greek equivalent of a flute. there might be some slaves there, or attendants, or you know whatever their status, who are there to sort of do the physical labor of manoeuvring the animal, basically.
Yeah, it's a lot of animal to room.
There's a lot. Yeah, absolutely.
You might have strong views.
Yeah, you might have a butcher. You might also have a separate auger, as it were. Auger is the wrong word because that's about birds, but someone who looks into the guts and sees the future. Or that might be the priest. Then when the animal gets there, they would throw sort of grains of like barley or whatever. In Greece, it'd probably be barley over the head of the animal. They would then cut some of the hair off the head and throw that onto the fire that is on the altar.
Yeah.
Then they would pour. They need to get the animal's consent, right? So what they would do is they would pour some water on the animal's head, and that would make the animal move its head up and down when the water hit it, and that
nodding.
It nodded. Exactly. And then if it's a big animal, like a cow, you'd probably have a slave or an attendant to bash it over the head with an axe to stun it. And then the priest would have a knife, but it would probably be hidden. Some of us would say it's hidden in a bushel of wheat. So the knife is concealed within a bushel of wheat. And so that it doesn't alarm the animal. And then you take out the knife and he would cut its throat. They would... and while this was happening, by the way, the women in attendance would make a high pitched sort of wailing, an ululation.
Ululating, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. While this happened at the actual moment of death, catch the blood in the bowl. Some of the blood would be poured upon the fire on the altar. And then you would open up the stomach, you pull out the guts, and you'd have a look at the liver to see what, you know, message the gods had for you in the liver, sort of a form of divination.
Or check if it has TB.
And then you would wrap up, basically you take out, the butcher would, the, it would then be, the animal would then be butchered, and the thigh bones would be wrapped in fat, and they would be put on the altar to be burned, along with the guts, maybe the entrails. And that was the portion for the gods. And then the rest of the animal will be butchered and most likely boiled, actually, in the classical period. And the meat would be distributed among the everyone who's attending the sacrifice.
Is that how meat was generally prepared, or was this special for...
In terms of boiling?
Yeah.
In the classical period, I you know what? I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that as a sacrifice, boiling was the normal method. I suspect because it's less intensive in its use of wood than if you were to roast it or the whole thing. Because you only need to...
Yeah, and I guess you think of stews and stuff, don't you? And you probably save more of the fat.
You know, in Homer, it's always roasted. But of course, Homer is always talking about a more heroic and prosperous time. We've talked about that before.
What would you do if we were awesome?
So it seems to have been boiled, and then it's distributed among the people attending the sacrifice. So they all have a lovely bit of protein. I think I've got the main elements there. I hope I have. So you have to imagine, this ceremony. It's a very, very closely prescribed ritual. Everything has to be done right or the sacrifice is wrong. It might even cause pollution if it's really, really wrong. It's really bad if you get it wrong. It has to be done exactly right. That's really, really important for it to have validity. You have to imagine the intensity, you know, it builds up to this moment of death. But the moment of death is also a moment in which life is sustained because, of course, the meat is given to everybody as food. It's the ritual that I think captures our imaginations most easily because it's so clearly to do with the interplay of life and death. And of course, sacrifice is absolutely central to ancient religions. And of course, most human religious, what we would call religious activities, have in most times, in most places, have involved some form of sacrifice. So it's absolutely fundamental. It seems to lie at the heart of what we would think of as the religious worldview. They would just think of it as their worldview. They wouldn't even think of it as that. They think of it as just reality.
That's what we do.
Yeah, it's absolutely fundamental. It's at the center. So it's this kind of big question mark, this elusive, tantalizing ritual that lies at the heart of almost all human. All human approaches to the sacred, because as we might get into, it's also at the heart of Christianity, of course. So that's interesting. It's interesting from that perspective.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting, just to lay out just a couple of points of discussion before we get into it. I think it's the other thing that I've been thinking about is that we use the word sacrifice all the time. And once you realize that and you've got a little bit of knowledge about what a sacrifice is and you've thought about some of the questions about, well, what does sacrifice mean? What's it all about? Why are they doing this? You start to notice how often the word sacrifice is used in the modern world. And you start to think, that's interesting.
It's a much more general term now, which is giving up something you value in expectation of a greater gain later. Or do you have a deeper point there?
I think that it can be used in that respect. It can be used in a quite secular way for just that kind of referring to the almost practical notion of giving up something for a future benefit, or even giving up something for not for a future benefit for you, perhaps, but for the benefit of somebody else.
Yeah.
But I think that when it's really used, that's a kind of a throwaway usage. I think when it's really used and meant, when people say sacrifice and they really mean it, I think that's very interesting. I'll just put one example of that. When we talk about war and the death of soldiers, that's when some people really start to mean the word sacrifice.
Yeah, and the ultimate sacrifice.
And that's really interesting because you think about, well, what is the relationship between that and the ritual that has pervaded human societies and cultures for almost all of our history? And you start to think, this is quite interesting.
Did you ever think that the COVID lockdowns and stuff, which were sometimes framed as a sacrifice that the young were making for the old, is that the same thing, or are we focusing really on blood here?
I think that is an example of that. I think that the concept was being invoked in order to justify a course of action that was perceived as extremely important at the time.
Yeah.
And I think that in that sense, it is the meaningful usage of it.
So it's trying to add it to the tradition. Yeah, this is part of the same tradition that...
Or trying to make sense of something within a familiar or common framework. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So those are that's the sort of the starting point of my thoughts on this. The other element that's been into this is that I've been reading this book called The Ruin of Cash by Roberto Colasso. Cash is not cash.
I've not heard of this.
It's not cash as in cash money. It's K-A-S-C-H. And it's this utterly baffling book by this kind of slightly... I mean, I have no idea whether he was actually mad. I've never met him. I don't think he's alive anymore, sadly. But he comes across as slightly unhinged kind of guy, Italian guy in the 80s. And it is one of those books that it's a bit like Sacrifice. It's all about sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
But he spends a lot of the time talking about Talleyrand, the 19th century French diplomat. it's a book that absolutely defies definition. I'm only really just over halfway through it.
Is it a novel or is it a...
I don't know. I don't even know.
Manifesto?
I wouldn't even know. It's just a kind of stream of consciousness about...
It's a text.
Yeah. It's a little stream of consciousness about interpretations of reality at the heart of which is the meaning of sacrifice. And I don't really know how to explain it other than that, but I will read a couple of quotations from it.
Please do.
He writes, "We establish a connection with the unknown through the act of giving something and, paradoxically, the act of destroying something. That is what is behind sacrifice. What you offer and what you destroy, it is that surplus which is life itself." There's another one. "Sacrifice requires perfect awareness of destruction. If this clear-sighted attention is missing, there is no sacrifice." Are you getting a flavour of the...
Yeah. Is this page one?
This is like page like 800.
Recurring motive. Yeah.
So I'll say that again. I'll do this because I think this one in particular is the one that really has caught my attention. "We establish a connection with the unknown through the act of giving something and, paradoxically, the act of destroying something." The idea that you connect with the unknown through destroying something. And that what you offer and what you destroy is the surplus which is life itself. So in some sense, the cow, let's say... Is you. So you are sacrificing the cow, but the cow is also you, because the cow represents the surplus which sustains your life. And all life,
as in 10% of your wealth, or
in one sense, yeah. But in a deeper sense, all life is contingent upon surplus, right? You need a surplus of energy for life, which is localized order to exist in the context of, you know, ever-increasing disorder, according to the second law of thermodynamics. So you're constantly having to feed in energy in order to sustain life, in order to keep it going.
Yeah.
In the same way that you constantly have to feed coal into a steam engine. And some of that energy that coal, you know, turns into steam, which turns into work, is lost through heat, right?
Yeah.
And so that means you always need to put in more, because you don't have a perfect transfer between, you know, material and work. So in other words, that life itself has to be, it is surplus. Otherwise it couldn't be sustained. And so when you're...
Like reminder of blind sight where consciousness is kind of surplus.
Yeah. So the in this way of looking at it, the animal that you offer is life itself, and by destroying it, you also sustain life. Because, and this is where, this gets to the heart of the weirdness of the ritual. It's that the ritual encapsulates this kind of mysticism that says life is death and death is life. And that little sort of bit of mysticism, I think, is what, you know, really gets the heart racing of all of these, you know, all of these kind of comparative mythologists and all of these sort of people that are slightly towards the fringe in terms of intellectualism, you know, and all of that kind of thing, because that's exciting, because that's the, there's something about that which you'll find in all of these different sort of mystical traditions, that life is death and death is life, you know, the yin and the yang, you know, and all that kind of thing. And it seems to, there seems to be a way of understanding sacrifice, that sacrifice is the central ritual to the central insight about the true nature of reality as it underlies everything that we see, which is the sort of the ultimate union of life and death. Which I think is pretty cool. And you think, well, I don't know, you think, you tell this to people, or you explain this to somebody you're sort of teaching something to, and they kind of are looking at you and they're kind of like,
Kind of like I am right now.
Yeah. They're like, okay. You know, that does, you know, that does sound interesting. It's a bit out there.
You have my attention.
Yeah, you know, how, kind of convince me kind of thing, but also this sounds a bit much, you know, and there's a whole kind of mix of responses there that are usually that are present. You have to remember that we are really, really weird in that we don't do sacrifice. You have to remember that in virtually all times, at all places, in all contexts, human beings who've never met each other.
Well,
in
societies, that's the thing here. It's not like it's there's a common ancestor here. No. Sacrifice has developed, it's co-evolved in a number of different places.
Yes, yeah, it's universal. It's universal.
Yeah, so it arises out of what we're doing as primitives.
Yeah.
Rather than something that someone learned to do and then passed down to their ancestors.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Because there are a lot of memes and stories and patterns that you can trace to a common ancestor. So I know someone did that with folklore in Indo-European culture. You trace back. So you see that, you know, some story involving a blacksmith is common to a lot of cultures. And so you kind of use that to identify when those cultures were last in the same place.
Mm.
And so there's a subgenesis of each of these traditions that can be identified.
But it's usually around the Black Sea, isn't it? It's usually between the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov or whatever it is. Yeah.
But this is not one of them.
Mm.
This is something that humans in their savage state, left their own devices, will eventually do.
It's a very loaded term, in their savage state.
In their... what would you call it before they know what the sacrifice is?
I'd say non-modern.
I mean, sacrifice isn't very modern.
Sorry, maybe I've misunderstood your question there. What would I call what?
The nature of the society in which you live before they start doing sacrifices.
Before they start... I'd say pre-human.
Oh, they're definitely human. We've been human for a long time.
Yeah, I think that sacrifice would have existed as soon as you had hunter-gatherer bands. I mean, I obviously have no evidence. I can't prove that to you. It's not a falsifiable claim, but that's my intuition.
I think I use the word savage because that's what Fraser uses in The Golden Bough.
In the 1930s.
Because obviously he deals a lot with this as well. Like
he does, yeah. Yeah,
largely
definitely.
About sacrifice.
It is, yeah. Yeah. Well, most of these kind of comparative studies, and also a lot of the psychoanalysts, like all of Freud and Jung, like when you really get down to brass tacks. It really is always there. But yes, you're absolutely right. So, you know, whenever it developed, you know, it developed so far back in the mists of time in so many different places that, I mean, it's basically, you know, contiguous with being human. My intuition. As I say, that's not a falsifiable claim. I don't know how you'd prove it one way or the other, but it depends on what your definition of human is, I suppose, as well. Once you get back a couple of 100,000 years, but
it's a bloodline, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe you can define the line as we become human when we start sacrificing.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. The animal that sacrifices.
That does make sense, because at one level, sacrifice is that giving up of something today in the hope of something tomorrow. And to know to do that is a function of higher intelligence.
Yeah, and it's also the idea of... You're right, and it's also the idea of structuring, creating a structure to manage and control or negotiate the uncontrollable and the chaotic, which is something that I think that... I think that's something that's quite distinctively human. I'd be thrilled to learn that other animals did something similar, but I suspect they don't.
I'm pretty sure not, though, that there is a moment of change between us thinking that the natural world is kind of just magic and just happens, and then actually trying to put an explanation on it, however.
Yeah, or taking on the responsibility for sustaining it, which I think is actually what a lot of sacrifice is about. It's about...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know, when you think about...
You're trying to have agency in the kind of magical realm or the supernatural realm. Yeah.
It's about seeing that... I mean, Roberto Colasso goes on about this. You know, as soon as you perceive that the world does not repeat itself perfectly in a pattern, that things change and you don't know why. The order in the world is not perfectly regular, that nothing's in equilibrium. As soon as you see that, the human response to that is to desperately try to keep it on track and keep it regular.
Yeah.
And this is related to agriculture as well, I think, but not necessarily. But you know, you can see this very easily in, when you think about the agricultural year. You want to keep things, you want to keep the crops growing every spring, and you want to keep the... You know, the sun shining, and you want to keep the sun rising, and you want to, you know.
And you have no idea that, you know, the sun will eventually rise. Like, there's no guarantee that it'll be spring again after winter.
Exactly.
Like, well, what's your basis for thinking that? And so you're going to do what you can to try and make it happen.
You do what you can. You're trying to manage your own anxiety about the future, but you're also, in a very, you know, literal sense, trying to sustain the whatever force it is that keeps the show on the road.
Yeah.
The unknown, basically.
Even if that means kind of reenacting it yourself.
Yes, in a highly ritualized and structured way. Yeah. And I think that's quite distinctively human. So you're right. I think actually, you know, you could probably make quite a convincing case that, you know, the definition of the boundary between pre-human and human is the institution of sacrifice.
Yeah, I think Jordan Peterson's already said something along those lines.
Has he? Yeah.
What I find interesting, though, is that we do the same thing, you know, sacrificing from the very dawn of humanity through to very recently. But we sort of have different stories to go behind it.
Yeah.
And I think that is part of Fraser's thesis in The Golden Bough, is that the rituals actually stay the same. It's the myths that change, the rationale that changes.
Yeah. And the stories you tell about why you're doing it change according to the needs
of
your...
You're doing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Because I mean, I suppose that because what I would think is that there's some fundamental process going on about that union between life is death and death is life, where you are both the sacrificer and the sacrificed in that one ritual conceptually, and that what you're doing is about sustaining the most fundamental force of life in that ritual of death. That's very hard to articulate, and you know the listener will appreciate that because they'll be thinking, "What on earth is this man chatting about? This is a load of nonsense." He hasn't articulated anything that makes sense. It's very hard to articulate, and so whenever there's a ritual that's about something really, really fundamental, that's actually quite hard to put into words because it is so fundamental. You tell stories about it, and those stories are going to be culturally contingent.
Yeah, and probably very strange. I mean, yeah, reading these kind of mythical stories from radically different cultures is always a bizarre experience. They make no sense at all because you've got no embodied feeling for it. But so, I mean, you're absolutely right that kind of the purpose of ritual is to put your body through something through that your brain would not rationally understand without having gone through a certain experience.
Yeah.
And Colasso says that as well. About. Yeah.
He says that if knowledge is not obtained through the wisdom of lived experience, it's basically just a correspondence course.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
And so these rituals allow you to live that experience in a kind of controlled environment.
It allows you to experience the union between life and death.
Yeah.
And you know, it allows you to, if you think about the intensity of that ritual, you watch the animal, which is a mammal, which you spend a lot of time with, being led towards the altar slowly. You know what's going to happen. The ritual builds and builds and builds until the moment of plunging the knife in and the women ululating and the blood flowing. You experience that death. It's an experience of death. You are in the mind of the animal, as you are the animal as well as the person observing the animal in that ritual. Because how can you not be? I mean, that's why I think it's so important that it's a mammal that we spend. I think that's one of the reasons why it tends to be these domesticated animals that we spend a lot of time with, because it is
not just a mammal but a familiar mammal.
It's a familiar mammal. It's because it's a proxy for us. You live death. You live through your own death in each sacrifice.
So does this make human sacrifice more understandable, and that you get an even stronger version of that if it's an actual human? Maybe.
I mean, I think that human sacrifice is a funny one. It's one of those things that's always taboo, as far as we can tell, in the historical record. People feel very strongly about it, and usually they feel very negative about it. But that just...
Well, it's normally the thing you say about the people you've just conquered or destroyed, is that they did human sacrifice.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite a regular trope, and maybe they did.
We've talked about before about the Carthaginians. There does seem to be evidence that they did.
Yeah.
The Tophets. Child sacrifice as well, particularly.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly unpleasant to think about.
On some scale.
Yeah. What I would say about that is that I think that with human sacrifice, there's this idea that you are drinking, I don't know, neat wine, you're drinking the pure ethanol.
Yeah.
And drinking the pure ethanol is not actually good. the ethanol is what makes you drunk. It is what makes the alcohol, it was what makes the drink work.
Yeah.
But if you have it pure, you kind of go blind. It's too strong. You can't handle it. So I think there's this sense in which you can't look directly at the sun.
Yeah.
You need the sun. You need to bask in the sun. The sun is very important. But if you look directly at it, you'll go blind.
Yeah.
And I think that human sacrifice is a bit like that. I think it's a bit like looking directly at the sun. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Taboo's an interesting thing, because quite often some members of the community will have the kind of freedom to ignore the taboo. Where am I going with that? I'm not implying secret human sacrifice in societies that disapprove of it.
Well, what I would say is that I think that our society, our modern society, and I think we do need to talk about the modern thing that's going on, which is actually much more deeply weird than I think most potential listeners would assume.
Mm.
When we talk about sacrifice in the modern world, we are usually talking about human sacrifice.
Yeah.
And again, I'll go back to the example of warfare. We talk about the sacrifice of soldiers and the sacrifice of, it's usually young men. You can see this really in the First World War, when people were trying to make sense of what had happened in the First World War. And there's this very, very strong strain of religiosity in the language about how this entire generation had been sacrificed. And it is like it's been a sacrifice to God. They express it in these terms, such that the nation can be sustained. They died so that we might live. That's what people say. I mean, that is the language that we are all familiar with from remembrance services.
Yeah.
And that idea that these young men are kind of throwing themselves into death in order to sustain what we value, in order to sustain the world.
And willingly, as the ox has to.
That it has to be willingly. That's the whole point. Like, it has to be willingly. That language and that notion really speaks to us, and it really moves us. I find it moving just to talk about now, because that is a, you know, it's deep. I would contend that the reason when you're kind of trying to culturally process a disaster or an event of that scale, the only language that you can use is the most deep and fundamental language. And what does it turn out to be? It's the language of sacrifice.
So is there an implication here? Because, I mean, the reason why we don't sacrifice in the West is because Christ, you know, was sacrificed for our sins.
Yeah, let's talk about Christ. What is going on with Christ? Because, right, so Christianity, why do we no longer do blood sacrifices to our God, right? That is the key question, the absolute key question. Why don't we do this anymore?
Well, because Jesus did it, and it's kind of, if you do it now, you're saying, well, was that not enough? You know, God sacrificing literally himself.
Exactly. So Christianity represents, it doesn't represent a sort of denial or a rejection of sacrifice, as people might naively assume. It doesn't represent sort of, oh, that was primitive and savage, and now we've got this nice friendly religion that's all about love. No. Christianity is sacrifice dialed up to 111, because it is centered on, conceptually and literally, the ultimate sacrifice that you could possibly conceive of, which is not sacrificing a cow. It's not even sacrificing a human being. It's God, the only God, sacrificing himself to us or for us. It is a encapsulation, absolutely maxed out and turbocharged, of the entire ritual, such that it almost abstracts the idea of sacrifice and says, right, that is the total sacrifice that for all time is done. And that is the foundation of the salvation of humanity, is the ultimate totalizing sacrifice. So it's almost like all of those sacrifices that were done by human beings in all those times and all those places over, you know, God knows how many thousands of years, have been leading up to this one climactic sacrifice that is the real ultimate sacrifice, which is the sacrifice of the God himself to himself on behalf of all humans everywhere for all time.
Yeah.
Thus completing the sacrifice quest. Yeah. and to the point, so after that, all sacrifice has to be abstracted, because all sacrifice is just a kind of a poor shadow of that sacrifice of Christ. So, yeah, exactly as you said, if you were to do a sacrifice now, it would just be a pale or perverted imitation.
Yeah, I mean, to inject something into that, though, I mean, when you go to Eucharist, so when you go to communion every Sunday, you are, in a sense, reliving part of that sacrifice. You're going to that moment of the Last Supper, where it was as the bull's being led up to the altar, basically.
Yeah.
Like that really intense moment there. And then also, if you sort of follow the church year, it all builds up to Lent, and then Holy Week, and then finally the Triduum, the kind of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and then Saturday, and then Easter Sunday, which if you go to kind of a good, you know, high church Anglican service on each of those days, you're actually led through that whole process of sacrifice, and you get that life and death experience that.
Well, yeah, I agree with
the sacrifice.
I agree with what you're saying, but it's kind of deconstructed and abstracted, though, isn't it?
Well, you don't have an actual cow dying.
Exactly.
But I think, other than that, though, I think you're being led through a psychologically very similar process if you commit to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that if you commit to it, if you really, you know, actively engage with those series of rituals, I think you can approach something like the psychological state. But it relies upon that intellectual engagement with something that is abstract behind a much more intellectualized series of rituals. It doesn't have that immediate visceral impact of you watching that animal go to the sacrificial knife, which bypasses the mind completely. It doesn't matter whether you believe, what you believe, whether you believe in Zeus or, any of the gods that have existed all over the place. You are that animal when you're watching it going up to that altar, knowing what's going to happen. You just can't help it. Like, you've got those, like, whatever it is, like mirror neurons or something. Like, you just, it bypasses everything that's intellectual. And in Christianity, I think that with an effort of engagement and reflection and piety, you can reflect on that sacrifice of Christ and get into the same mindset, and perhaps you can even go beyond it into that kind of totalizing sacrifice. But as soon
you've got to really focus.
And as soon as, now that the Christian grip on culture is completely fractured and broken, it means that we are now completely untethered.
Yeah. So we've got this sacrifice-shaped hole in our consciousness that was appeased by the Eucharist, but now most people don't do that.
And then you start to think about, and when did this happen? It happens in the 20th century, right?
Yeah.
And then you think about what happens in the 20th century, and you're kind of like,
Yeah, the world wars are bad, but I mean, we've been fighting each other a very long time. It just happened that by the world wars, we had the technology to really efficiently or inefficiently.
I mean, it's a mystery in the sense, because untangling that knot is very hard. But I don't think that it. I think that it is relevant, and I think that I don't think it's illegitimate to just point out that what happens in the 20th century is there's almost like a kind of there's a drive among some ideologies, which are all post-Christian ideologies, Nazism, communism, to bring about the death on such a scale, and they can bring about death on such a scale, and it's always articulated using language that is either explicitly or subliminally sacrificial. I mean, the word Holocaust is literally the name given to a particular type of sacrifice, right? That's what the word means. It's a burnt offering from the Old Testament. It's when you burn up the animal completely, so you don't eat it, you just burn the whole thing. I hope I'm remembering that correctly.
I mean, the sort of thing you would once you've heard it.
I'm very happy to be corrected, but I think that's right. When you think about, it wasn't the Nazis that called it the Holocaust, of course. It was conceived of that late, it was given that name by others.
Yeah, that turned up later. Yeah.
Yeah. But the idea that when you look at Nazism itself, say, Hitler and how he conceives of, say, I've read this book about Stalingrad, and I was talking to you last episode about how Stalingrad is just completely nuts. It's just absolutely mental. You think that, these hundreds of thousands of men on the steppe in minus 25 degrees doing this to each other in the most unbelievable suffering, and just, it's just crazy, right? The level of horror. And Hitler is sitting there, and he is explicitly thinking about the idea that the Sixth Army is nobly sacrificing itself in the name of sustaining the German nation. And German soldiers in Stalingrad are saying that. And, you just think, well, it just seems very notable that we always reach for that mental construct when we're dealing with something that seems to reveal this yawning abyss of death. We always reach for that construct about sacrifice as a way of coping with it.
Well, I mean, back to phrases like the rituals stay the same, the myths change. Is it the other way around, where we're going to do the thing and it's just, on whatever scale, and the language you use to justify it changes? So it's more that we are committing a sacrifice and then telling a story about it, rather than doing something abhorrent and then calling it a sacrifice.
Yeah, I think that speculating about, say, Hitler's mindset is a fool's game, because
a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
Have you ever read how many drugs? Yeah,
Yeah, a lot of was it methamphetamines that he was taking?
Yeah, but just a lot, like everything.
Yeah, gun oil
at the same time.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a fool's game again to speculate about subconscious motivations and, you know, what's going on subconsciously in any individual's mind. I mean, who knows, like, at the end of the day. But when you just kind of take a step back and you look at it and you notice these kind of similarities of language and you think about how sacrifice has been absolutely universal everywhere at all times until, boom, you know, 20th century, you know, 19th, 20th century, suddenly, you know, modernity, the Enlightenment, Christianity, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, it starts to be sort of extracted, you know, abstracted.
Mm.
And then all of this stuff happens that then is you know, people conceive of it or they make sense of it using the same language. And you start to think,
It sort of makes sense. It's accepted and feel it's right. I mean, the thing that freaked you out about that Stalingrad book was the fact that they saw nothing wrong with what they were doing.
Yeah, some of them did. Others didn't, you know.
But it just seemed to fit into a pre-existing pattern.
It fits into... And you know what? There's this amazing piece of artwork it was drawn, actually. I think it's pencil. In the Kessel. So the Kessel is German for the cauldron. So the trapped Sixth Army, they were encircled by the Russian armies in Stalingrad and they just suffered and suffered and suffered. Anyway, I'm not saying that wasn't a good outcome for everyone in general, but it being a Nazi army and everything, but you can still have empathy for the pure suffering that went on all sides. Anyway, there's a piece of artwork that was done by a German officer. And it's called the Stalingrad Madonna. And so you've got to think about these soldiers who have been indoctrinated into Nazism. And the things that they've done as they've kind of rampaged across Russia or that they've allowed to happen, that they've known are happening, you know, absolutely horrendous. The things that they are doing, even at the time, still to their prisoners and all of that kind of thing, who are in the Kessel, are, you know, shocking moral atrocities. And yet, even so, you know, there are some people in that Kessel when it's the bleakest possible situation that a human being can be in, right? And there's one of them that draws this piece of art called the Stalingrad Madonna. And you look at it and it's of the Madonna and child. Mm. And it looks a bit like a heart and a bit like a womb. And it's an image of utter, utter beauty and tenderness. And I find it so moving. Because it's got so many contradictions inherent in it. You know, that has been drawn by a Nazi officer in Stalingrad. And you just think, there's something very, very deep going on here. You know, that doesn't just come out of nowhere. That is, there's something so profound about it. And at the center of it, of course, is Christ and, you know, the mother of Christ. And I think that you can't just dismiss this stuff as like, oh, this is just froth on top of the reality. You know, the reality is all just like economics and like, you know, production figures and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And all this kind of, you know, this religious stuff about sacrifice and stuff is just froth on the top, you know. No, it's not, because it is the most fundamental core of our psychological experience of the world and, or just our experience of the world. Psychological is a redundant term there. Just our experience of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's there and it comes out in the most extreme circumstances. Whenever we're dealing with something that is the most extreme, that's when
We're on the edge.
That's when it pops out. And it pops out in its most profound way. You think, I don't think that it's reasonable to just dismiss that. I think that you can sit up and take notice of that and think, that's really interesting. And what he wrote on it was Christmas in the Kessel, like life, light and love or something like that. That's what he wrote in German around it.
Licht, Leben, Liebe.
Yeah. You just think, wow. You know.
In Stalingrad.
Yeah. It was flown out of the Kessel. So they recognised it. The people around him recognised it.
Yeah, everyone around him was like, oh, dude, you done... Like, yeah. Let's say,
it became a sort of shrine. His bunker became a sort of shrine. And they made sure it was flown out of the Kessel. Amidst all the chaos and carnage and terror and horror, they made sure that was flown out. You just think, wow. you know. And the comparison of, you know, they're Nazis, they're literal Nazis, they're the worst,
the actual Sixth Army.
And they, and there's one individual in it that in that extreme circumstance produces that. Like, it's in deep. It's in really, really deep. So anyway, there's some of my thoughts about that. But yeah, so sacrifice. I think that what I would say is that I'd encourage everybody to just notice, prick your ears up when the word sacrifice is used and think about, you know, why is that word being used?
Yeah. Why am I accepting it?
Yeah. And to go, yeah, to go back to your thing about lockdowns, I think, you know, that is an extreme. We all felt it was pretty extreme at the time, extreme circumstance. And so we reached for that language. We're sacrificing something so that the world may be sustained. Yeah. Any thoughts, critiques, questions?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I don't know what to do with this knowledge.
I don't know, it's not clear what you would do with the knowledge, is it?
Yeah, because like, are we saying that, well, we should actually just... Clearly we have a fundamental, almost physiological need for performing animal sacrifices, and so we should, since no one's going to church anymore, those who don't should get the benefit of someone occasionally killing a bull in a public space and I mean, I do think we have a general problem of not experiencing death. I think we've talked before about how death isn't something we really accept as real until it's thrust upon us.
Yeah.
And then we try and get out of that situation as quickly as we possibly can and not think about it.
Yeah, which leads to terrible outcomes for everyone.
Yeah. And potentially, yeah, the sacrifice also helps with that. If you're just used to the cycle of life and death.
Well, talking about it's worth thinking about our own attitude to meat, right? Because, of course, for the ancients, meat was only ever really accessed through sacrifice, right? That's how you access meat.
It's through sacrifice. Valuable animal. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to just butcher an animal. It will always be sacrificed because if you're killing an animal to eat it, you're always going to sacrifice it. Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's not a very different process. And then also with a cow, I mean, because you don't have fridges, you've got to eat it within
a
day.
You've got
so
to eat it.
So you're going to give it to everyone. And yeah, it's
yeah.
Be a big
and the point is that when they sacrifice their cow, you get a bit. So you do get the whole cow over time, but through the kind of communal element of everybody giving you a bit of their cow when they kill it. So it's that kind of reciprocal thing. It's worth thinking about, right, so anthropologists have obviously studied, they particularly love studying the Papua New Guinea and Polynesia, right, anthropologists, right? And they had a particular field day.
Yeah, they were kind of untouched.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quite recently.
Yeah. So they had a real field day with this in the 60s in particular, where there were all of these kind of uncontacted tribes, and there's literally hundreds and hundreds of them. And when anthropologists went and lived among these tribes, some of them had obviously come into contact with what we would think of as modernity, and they were in the process of moving from their former, what we would think of as religious systems, to Christianity. And so you were able to catch them in the transition.
Yeah.
And the Polynesians, there were some Polynesians who, the ones who were Christian said, you know, all these silly people sacrificing, they're just, you know, all their gods do is waste chickens, right? So that's what they said about sacrifice. They sort of, you know, were very dismissive of it. And they said, the gods are just wasting chickens. But the people who were sacrificing it, were still sacrificing, were not Christian, said, Christians, I'm quoting here, I got this from an online article. We can put the link in the show notes. Christians kill with no words. They are greedy, slaughtering animals whenever they feel like it, just so they can eat meat. So from the perspective of somebody who's within a world in which sacrifice still takes place, our system of just killing an animal whenever we want to eat it with no words, with no ritual, is horrendous. Because we're still killing the animal.
Yeah.
we're just,
it's the same outcome.
It's the same outcome, just without the the meaning. And that got me thinking, you know, I think the closest people to, in the modern world, who the people who are closest to the people who, in attitude to the people who would have been sacrificing in the ancient world, are probably ethical vegetarians. Because an ethical vegetarian will say, well, I don't believe in just killing animals for meat.
Yeah. Right?
They'll say that, oh, yeah, that's wrong. I don't want to do that. You know, they'll say, you know, these factories about sort of, you know, cows are slaughtered on an industrial scale and battery hens, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. They'll say, well, that's horrendous. That's a moral atrocity. We shouldn't be doing that. And so I'm not having any part of it. And I think that even meat eaters would probably, when we sit down to think about it, we're like, yeah, actually, that is a moral atrocity. We probably shouldn't have any part of it. Right? And
so
they are saying that actually animals have dignity and they should be treated with dignity, and yeah, we shouldn't just be slaughtering them in terrible conditions for our own comfort, just, you know, in a kind of a throwaway manner.
Yeah, for so which steaks is, are yeah, a bit which, cheaper, yeah.
Yeah, which seems very similar to me to that Polynesian who says, well, the Christians are terrible. They just kill whenever they want meat with no ritual. That seems to be quite a close position. I mean, it's not identical, but it's not far apart. And I think that actually a lot of ethical vegetarians, if you said to them, well, actually, you know, if we were to completely break down sort of big meat processing and meat was to be quite rare and, you know, it was animals that we had sort of raised locally and they were killed humanely in a meaningful way and we had a relationship with those animals, I think quite a lot of them would say, well, I'd be much more happy with that. You know.
Yeah, and at the same time, a lot of people who eat a lot of meat now would be a bit squeamish about that, maybe.
They would, yeah, they would.
Prefer not thinking about it.
So I think that, you know, we still do kill animals all the time for meat. And so when you're thinking about, well, we don't have sacrifice anymore in our culture, it's just another way in which actually, well, hang on, do we or don't we? Because we kill animals all the time for meat, and that's a key part. That's what sacrifice is killing an animal for meat. But now we just do it without the ritual, without the meaning, without the value of the animal. The only value is in the meat, not in the animal. And so that kind of fundamental contract between us and the world is another way in which it's sort of a bit fractured.
Yeah, and obviously in ancient times, not every animal was slaughtered ritually. Like, a lot of them were just killed because you need meat. But the fact that some were brought dignity to it, would you say? Mm.
I would say probably that I don't actually know this. I don't know whether anybody knows this, but I actually don't think that animals would have just been butchered without being sacrificed. I think whenever you were killing an animal in the ancient world, you would do it as a sacrifice, even if it was just a sort of not a formal one. You would just, you know, you wanted to have some chicken or whatever, and you're on a farmstead in Attica, and you want to, yeah, you know, you think, right, I'm going to. Or you want to eat your goat or whatever.
Yeah.
I think you would sacrifice it. You might do it on your own personal little altar in the home, in the oikos. But I don't think you would just butcher it without it being dedicated to some sort of god. Because meat is so rare in the ancient world. You know, you've got to imagine you're almost never eating meat in the ancient world because animals are so valuable. That whenever you do slaughter one of your animals for meat, it's a big deal. And why wouldn't you sacrifice it? You're going to get the meat anyway. There's no cost to doing it properly. So I've always just assumed that every animal that was killed for meat in the ancient world, every domesticated mammal at least, is sacrificed. I don't know. I'm happy to be corrected by.
Yeah, I mean, I've got nothing.
By other classicists who might be listening and say, actually, no, that's wrong. I mean, obviously, you're not sacrificing fish. Like, you catch a fish, you're not sacrificing it, you're just eating it. And actually, a lot of their diet in terms of protein would have been fish, so...
Yeah, you know. And hunting, I guess, as well. Like, you're not... Although I think, yeah, if you're killing an antelope or something, there is that moment.
Well, some anthropologists say that, you know, ultimately, sacrifice developed out of hunting. So, you know, there's one... chap, I can't remember his name, we'll put it in the show notes, who wrote Homo Necans, which is Latin for man the killer, killing man.
Yeah.
And he basically, his whole thesis is that the reason we sacrifice, the reason everybody sacrifices everywhere is because it's an expression of our communal need. It's our expression of our need to kill together as a community that developed from us being hunters, cooperative hunters. And so for him, sacrifice is the absolutely fundamental community bonding kind of ritual.
Part of our natural behavior that needs to be expressed somehow.
Yeah, you need it in order to bind together your community.
Or rather, like if you don't let a chicken preen, it gets stressed. If you don't let a human kill, it gets stressed.
Yeah, I think he would probably start to go along those lines. But his specific thing is
again, we come around to the fact we don't have that now, and therefore, is that causing psychological trouble?
Well, we do watch videos of being killed online, of people being killed in Ukraine from drones. You know, and people will watch it and be fascinated by it.
Well, you say we. I mean, a lot of people,
Yeah, I mean,
I'm teenage boys, people over that,
I mean, you know,
people would be hunting.
What the chap who wrote Homo Nacans would say is that it's about binding the community together. So he'd say the only way that you can really bind together a community is through a shared act of violence. And again, you think, oh, that's horrendous. That's a horrendous thought. But then you think, hang on.
I'd certainly agree about a shared act of transgression brings people together. I mean, that's why you know, business people would go to the strip clubs or whatever, or now go to karaoke, because you're sharing that act of transgression. and all of these are less intense than killing someone. So yeah, probably if you want to get a group of guys working well as a team.
It doesn't have to be, again, it doesn't have to be killing someone. I mean, actually, you would probably say you would probably say that the point of doing it as a sacrifice is that so you don't end up killing a human.
Yeah.
You take it out on the animal, which is a proxy for a human. Yeah. You know, and once again, you get back to that idea that you are both the sacrificer and the sacrificed. The animal is a proxy for all kinds of things, but ultimately it's a proxy for you, the human. And so by doing the sacrifice, you bond together, you get the benefit of bonding together as a community through that act of sort of transgression, killing. And that paradoxically sustains life, because you need to be a community to live and to succeed. So once again, you get that weird duality between you need to have perfect awareness of destruction in order to create, in order to sustain. And I think there's a very fundamental insight in that, is that, you know, you try living without hurting or damaging anything or anybody. Good luck, you know.
Yeah, the Buddhists try not to kill anything, even an ant. Gets quite impractical pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, good luck. I mean, life is damage. It's damage to you, and it's damage to everything you come into contact with. I mean, that's kind of what life is. And sacrifice kind of encapsulates that and controls it.
Yeah. Gives you agency in it. And you're accepting it.
Yeah, and you're accepting it, exactly. Yeah. So is it, you know, community bonding as well? It's another element to it.
And again, something we've lost a bit in the modern era.
But at the same time, one of the things that people would have said about lockdowns is that, oh, it really brought us all together. You know, it's terrible. But I really felt part of a community.
Felt like we were part of something, yeah.
I really felt part of something for the first time in my life, you know, when we were all banging pans together and all that kind of thing. So the idea is that, I think you can observe that. You can observe that when people are making sacrifices, whether it's lockdown or killing a cow, they also feel very strongly bonded together.
Yeah.
And so is actually sacrifice, is it at the heart of human social cooperation? Because that would be another reason why it's seen everywhere and at all times in all places. And it's also might be why at the moment we kind of have this slight sense of malaise in our societies about how united we are, because we don't have that shared ritual of sacrifice that binds us together into a community, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, I sacrifice more than half of what I earn to the government in taxes, and that doesn't feel the same.
Bit of a flex there.
Maybe, well, I'm including the VAT I then pay. If you add all my petrol tax and if you add it all together, not on my special ultra-rich 6% tax rate.
No, it's not quite the same, is it?
No. There may be, if I did it in a tax return rather than it being taken by PAYE, that there'd at least be a moment.
There'd be a moment where you signed it off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go. Anyway, so yeah, it's a deep pool for this.
It's a very deep pool, yeah.
For this episode of Battles of Spirit. I mean, I don't know.
It's on the edge of being actionable.
Yeah.
We sort of established that it is kind of healthy and necessary to do this, both for group bonding and for your individual psychological health.
Yeah. And also literally to just literally sustain your life. Like, you have to sacrifice things in order to sustain your life. You have to kill, you have to damage things in order to live yourself, because you have to take in resources into yourself. And for that, you have to damage things to get the result. There's no other way. So I think it's more about that. Once you realize that you can sort of make a lot of more sense of a lot more things. And it kind of goes into everything, really.
It's a useful tool. Intellectual tool.
Something we could come back to. Sacrifice. It's the new buzzword.
Yeah,
Of Echoes Underground. Sacrifice.
You'll see it everywhere.
Yeah.
You'll see it everywhere too.
I know.
Just wait.
Yeah. It's coming. Anyway. Matters of Spirit, episode 2, complete.
Yeah. For the win.
Yeah. I have no idea whether that made any sense or not. Anyway, we'll leave it to the judgment of prosperity. Or is it posterity, rather?
Yeah. Felt intense.
I need to finish that. You know, you wrote 9, Roberto di Classe. So the Ruin of Cash is just the first one in a like a 9-book series on just everything. So, it's got a lot of reading to do.